Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Tonight, we have two wonderful writers, Mark Salzman and Nora Gallagher, and they're going to both read their work and also talk about their time at the McDowell Colony and the effect that has had on their work. I can remember sending Mark Salzman a cartoon, actually, when he was a resident at the McDowell Colony, which was a very funny picture of a writer chained in a cell, and there was a faucet with a spigot that only dispensed black coffee, and you had to stay in there until you produced something. But really, it's really much more delightful than that, much, much more delightful than that at writers' colonies and artists' colonies. And the role of these places in the creation of art in American culture is really an untold story. So tonight we have two marvelous authors who have both been residents at McDowell, and they're going to help. This is a helping to celebrate the centenary of the McDowell Colony, the nation's first artist residency program, which has been a model for hundreds of others. And by the way, are there any folks in here who have been to McDowell? That would be fun to know, and I'm sure a few. Okay, well, welcome, especially welcome. Nora Gallagher is the author of two memoirs, the best-selling Things Seen and Unseen, A Year Lived in Faith, and Practicing Resurrection. And her recent novel, Changing Light, is told against the backdrop of Los Alamos, New Mexico, and the final innocent days of the world before the atom bomb. Nora's essays, book reviews, and journalism have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times Magazine and the Los Angeles Times, and she's received fellowships from the Wesleyan Writers Conference, Blue Mountain Center, McDowell Colony, and the Mesa Refuge. Nora Gallagher is a preacher in residence at Trinity Episcopal Church in Santa Barbara, and she's on the advisory board of the Yale Divinity School. Mark Salzman, who you might have heard before from the on the stage, is an award-winning novelist and nonfiction author. His first memoir, Iron and Silk, was inspired by his years in China and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction and received the Christopher Award. His book, True Notebooks, is a fascinating look at Mark's experiences as a writing teacher at the Los Angeles Central Juvenile Hall. He's also the author of the memoir, Lost in Place, Growing Up Absurd in Suburbia, and the novels The Laughing Sutra, The Soloist, and Lying Awake. Mark is also a cellist, and his playing appears as the soundtrack to several films, including the Academy Award-winning documentary Breathing Lessons, The Life and Work of Mark O'Brien. And Mark's life's trajectory is also explored in a new film by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Jessica Yu. It's called Protagonists, and a plug for it, I've seen it, it's quite wonderful. It opens, I think, the first week of December at the Lemley in Pasadena and maybe one other venue. So check it out. Mark is in it, and also the writer Joe Loya, who has been on this program. So please have a wonderful evening. Please welcome Mark Salzman and Nora Gallagher. Bye-bye.
We have to remember to put the mics up to our mouths here. Well, we're going to start by just telling you a little bit about our experiences at McDowell. And I know that Louise asked you whether there are people here who've been to McDowell. Do you mind raising your hands again to say, oh, great, good. It is the oldest colony in the United States, and we're celebrating its 100-year anniversary this year. And I've been there, I guess, well, I've been there once. I was except in residency twice, and you've been there once. And I'm just going to tell you a little story about my first few days at McDowell. What you need to know without, the only really thing you need to know is that I was born and raised in New Mexico, where we have a lot of desert and a lot of long vistas and no deciduous trees, right? A lot of sun. And I arrived at McDowell very ambivalent about what I was going to do. I applied in both fiction and nonfiction because I still didn't know what I wanted to do there. So I was dragging a lot of baggage with me. And I got there at 2 p.m. in late October, twilight in New Hampshire in October. And David Macy, who's the executive director, took me down that little dirt road to my cabin, and it was deep in the woods. It was so dark, I could barely make out my hand in front of my face. Did I tell you it was raining? So I walked in the door, and Mark, I'm sure you have this memory too, is across the cottage, on the mantelpiece of the huge stone fireplace, which was dripping wet rain, were the tombstones, what they call the tombstones, which are the wooden tablets on which other writers have inscribed their names. It's what you do when you leave your cottage at the end of your residency. You inscribe your name on this wooden tablet. And far off in the dim light, I could see the name Jonathan Franzen. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. So I burst into tears. And David Macy patted me very gently on the back, and he said, yes, this happens to many people who come here, the gratitude they feel in their hearts. And I, of course, couldn't tell him that I was sobbing in misery. And the next thing that happened was I went to the dining hall. The bell rang for dinner, and I went to the dining hall. And at McDowell, they have overlapping residencies, so people don't come in all at once. They come in, you know, for 4 weeks. Maybe a group of people will be together, and then some new people will come in, and then, you know, more people will come in. So it's you can stay at different times. I think there were some people who lived there, but. So I went to the dining hall, and I was greeted with, you know, the people were sitting at various tables, and they looked at me with that look of high school, you know, the late student arrival. And I sat down and had a sort of early and uncomfortable evening. But that weekend, I was scheduled to go visit my husband, who was in residency at the Blue Mountain Center, which is another colony, not too far away. And so I drove up there thinking to myself, what can I do about this situation at McDowell? And the first evening I was sitting at the big communal table at the Blue Mountain Center, I looked around to find the youngest person I could find in the room. And I spotted a guy dressed completely in black leather from top to bottom. And he had a ring in his nose from which you could have hung a towel, I think. And so I sidled up to him after dinner and I said, do you remember high school? Again, he allowed us how he did. And so I said to him, you know, I'm having some trouble. I'm in this colony a little far down south here and I'm feeling like I failed in high school. I can't remember what you're supposed to do. He said, it's very simple. I'm going to teach you four things. First, don't suck up to the popular people. I had already done that. I told a novelist who's not a word of which I'd ever read of her work that I loved it. He said, secondly, you got to walk in that dining hall and you got to sit alone at a table. It's going to take all your courage. You got to do that. He said, that's two. He said, number three, the first people who are going to come and sit with you are going to be the nerds. And you got to be nice to them. But don't be too nice or they'll cling. I said, okay. He said, finally, the people who will finally come and sit with you will be your true friends. And that was exactly what happened. And that's what McDowell ended up giving me, was my true friends. We were just talking about this before we came in, that the friendships that you make in a spot like that are very much like the friends you make in college, that they are, you know, lifelong and valuable and a great companionship in the lonely world of writing. So that's my McDowell story.
Nice. Well, what I thought I would talk about is sort of what state of mind I was in when I went there, and then how the effect of this sort of solitude, how it affected me. And I should explain that I was really reluctant to, I had no idea what these places were. They sounded like cult groups to me. But my wife had been to this colony once before. She really liked it. She kept pushing me, Mark, you should go to this place. And I kept saying, why? Why do I need that? I work at home. I've got the bedroom. I've got all the solitude I need. She said, no, there's something special about it. Well, I didn't really listen to her until I was really at the end of my rope. I've been working for years on a novel that was just falling apart. It was just, in a nutshell, it was about a cloistered Carmelite nun with epilepsy. And during the writing of this book, I became deeply, I began to have real crisis of confidence about my whole, this whole endeavor of being a writer. Each of my books was selling fewer copies than the last, and then here I was working on this book in my mid-30s, and I remember that an issue of the New Yorker magazine came out, and the title of it was The 20 Best Young American Novelists in America, you know, and I wasn't one of them, and it really, oh God, the envy, the anger, the resentment, the sense of failure and all was just awful. So as I was working on this book, I remember becoming suddenly very nervous that, you know, I'm becoming niche-y. This is my problem, is my books are about oddball things that only I could be interested in. Why would anyone, I keep forgetting to ask, why would anyone want to read this? And so my responsibility as a writer, if I want to become a really good writer, is I've got to figure out, I've got to ask the question, what would other people want to read? And so I decided that this story about this nun's question of whether her mystical visions were authentic or not was just too niche-y. So I thought it would be more accessible to people if she fell in love with her neurologist. So I spent years working on this really just excruciatingly stupid novel about this romance, because I thought it was going to be like, remember the movie Witness, the Harrison Ford thing, where he's the tough cop and she's a little blue Amish or something, and you know, he's grizzled and she's got the bonnet, and I thought this will be even better. She's got a habit, he's got a lab coat, and just, you know, the conflict of worlds. And as I wrote this thing, I was having such trouble. I'd spend days on a single sentence. I couldn't get these people to act in ways that were at all real. They were just like cardboard. Do you think God exists in the brain? I don't know. I'm just a nun. And nothing was real about them. So I'd just driven myself nearly crazy, and I was so frustrated. At one point, I spent a year writing in the passenger seat of my car, because when I was in the house, even the slightest sound distracted me so much, I decided I've got to do something about it. So I put an old bath towel around my head and put a pair of old broken headphones over that. Well, that worked out the sound problem, but I still had cats that liked to sit on my lap. And so I'd read somewhere that cats don't like tinfoil, so I made a tinfoil skirt that I wore with the bath towel and the headphones. And one day I look out the window, and there's the gas meter reader looking at me. So that's what got me to the car, and then I spent a year in the car, and every day the cats were pissed off that I'd left the house would climb up onto the moonroof and sit. And, you know, it was the perfect metaphor for what I was going through. I was sitting under a cat's ass the whole time. I sent draft after draft of this off to my editor, and she sent them back saying how awful they were, and I just couldn't figure out. So there came a point where I really was defeated. I just felt so you know the deal. When you're trying to make something, you're trying to be authentic, and it's failing, and the harder you try, the worse it gets, the more stupid you become, to the point where you just really give up. And at that point, that's when Jessica said, you need to get out of the house. So she forced me to apply to this place, and when I went, I didn't want to work on this book anymore. I didn't know what to do with it. I'd written it so many times, I couldn't think of anything. But I tried to sort of maintain a confidence. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go out there and work. But the truth is, I went out there, and as soon as I got there and saw this cabin, I'm from Connecticut, so this was familiar. I felt great to be there in the fall. I was happy to be in my dark little cabin. I thought, I'm not going to write a word. I bought a wine in a box, and I set it up on the porch, and I sat out there. I said, this is all I'm going to do. I'm going to spend 5 or 6 weeks remembering that a world exists outside of my whole little drama about whether I'm a writer or not. Well, the second day I was there, I went in to pick up a box, and one of the people that works at the desk at the main building, I remember, you feel obliged when you see the people that work there to say, I'm going to be productive. You know, you want to just say, like, boy, I can just tell this is really going to work well. And so I remember saying to her something like, I'm going to use this time. And she looked up and she said, well, you know, we here don't expect that at all, just so that you know. In fact, if you don't do anything here at all, if all you do is relax, that's perfectly acceptable to us, because the whole point of this here is we're here to be supportive. You know, creative people don't get a lot of support in the world. And so the idea here is that if rest is what you need, that's what you get. So there's no, you don't have to prove anything to us. Well, I went right back to wine the box. Woo-hoo! And within a few days, I actually did relax, and I started to then just enjoy things in the way that, you know, when you're really tense about something, you really can't stop your mind thinking about it. You dwell, you brood, and it ruins everything. It just becomes it's a cycle you can't get out of. And when you can finally just take your mind, when your mind finally quiets down, you're not thinking about it, I remember I just felt elated, you know, just from the relief of not being burdened by all that stuff. And in that sense of release, I remember feeling, as I hadn't for a long time, that I was exactly where I should be, and I was doing exactly what I should be doing. Now, I really believe, I don't know about you, but that's been my lifelong goal, my dream in life, is I want to go through life feeling that I'm where I should be and I'm doing what I should be doing. Everything else, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as I feel that way, I'm going to be happy. That's what I want. And I felt that way there, and I felt so good that then I looked at this manuscript, and it was so obvious what was wrong with it. That whole love story thing, it was just so plain that was so artificial. And so I decided, you know what? I'm just going to write this thing without that romance at all. I'm just going to have fun with this. And I was really I was freed from trying to do all the things I've been trying to do in addition to just telling this story. And I actually had a wonderful experience writing it. When I came home, I remember thinking to myself, I've got to remember what were the circumstances that made me feel this way. Because, of course, no one wants to feel that you can only feel that way at a writer's colony. Because how often can we go? I mean, I'm a parent now, right? I got 2 young kids. I'm applying for my next fellowship in the fall of 2028. So what am I going to do till then? So, of course, I think the question that interests me now that maybe we'll explore later is, what are the conditions that make you feel that way, and can we cultivate them at home? Are these things that we can actually experience in ordinary life without having those extraordinary circumstances? So that's my little presentation. Yeah.
That story is a wonderful story. That cat's ass is really the end.
Yeah, yes it is.
It was the end.
It was the end.
I think our plan now is that we're going to read a little bit from stuff we wrote while we were there. We hope we wrote while we were there, or maybe started while we were there.
Okay.
I'm going to read from my novel, Changing Light, which I actually did work on at McDowell. I think I'm going to try reading it just from the chair. And if you can't hear me or my voice cracks from this endless cold that I have, I'll get up and read from the podium. So just wave if you can't hear me or it's not working. This novel, as I said, was started at McDowell. In some ways, I had a similar experience you had, which is I had started it maybe 6 years before and just put it away in a drawer and I kind of pulled it out when I was applying to McDowell and thought, oh, well, what the hell, which I think is always, often a good option for anything. It takes place in 1945 in New Mexico when they were building the bomb at Los Alamos. And I owned some land near Santa Fe for a while, and I was walking on it one day and looked across the Rio Grande and realized that Los Alamos was actually much closer to the city than I had thought. It's really right across the river and on the other side of a mesa from Santa Fe. And I wondered that day what would have happened had one of the physicists decided to leave the project. In the summer of 45, when the Nazis were defeated, and try to work against stopping the bomb on Hiroshima. So this is a love story. And my physicist's name is Leo, and he has left Los Alamos after an accident. And he's been found beside the river by a young woman painter who's come to New Mexico to recover her art. And her name is Eleanor. And he's been at her house for just about a week and a half recovering. And they've had a misunderstanding. And he has had to leave. So he's walking from her house to Santa Fe at nightfall, and it's beginning to snow. He got to the rock and placed a hand against it as if touching home base in a child's game of hide-and-go-seek. He looked up the road and saw a tree, this one low and round, rather like a cypress from his youth, when the family had gone to the seashore for bathing. He tried not to think of his youth. Hidden among his memories, he realized, was an irritant, a faint scraping at the edge of his consciousness, something that had always been there in the dark, but dislodged by the accident, set free to float, as if a bit of moss had been loosened from the bottom of a lake. He had thought all this time that he was working on the gadget. No, here in the snow alone, he would call things as they were, the bomb. He had told himself that he worked on the bomb for the sake of his sister, to blow the Germans to kingdom come, whatever the risk to the world. And of course, because the Germans were working on the bomb themselves. He had wanted to end their awful sense of a right to dominate, their pitiless arrogance. He had pictured more than once Hitler being blown to bits and been surprised by the amount of pleasure it gave him. But here in the snow, leaning against this cold ancient rock on this long empty road, freezing, he realized the lie he had told himself. Without his contribution, they simply would not be where they were. He remembered Fermi looking up at him when he had said chain reaction, and the light in that handsome face. Being part of the brightest group of men ever assembled, and more than any of that, being part of something so large, so completely, he almost laughed at the innocence of the word that came to his mind to describe the project, so completely practical. No more theory, no more working in space. No, this had a real object, a real goal, as real as the rock under his hand. They would actually put all of the theory to use and find out if it really worked. Make a material object, a practical military weapon. And this weapon would... His mind went blank, muddled. Keep going, whispered a part of his thoughts. Keep going. It would destroy whole cities at once and kill hundreds of thousands of people. They would die exactly as Leo stopped. He had worked on the bomb because he had enjoyed it. He'd liked the science and the camaraderie and the solving of problems one by one. He had seen his theory made real, and he had reveled finally in the power it gave him. Until he had seen just precisely what was to come, what would be unleashed, what would fly from the box they had opened. He made for the tree. The sky was darkening, the light was fading, night. Panic rose in his throat. If he didn't get somewhere by night, then he really was done for. He felt furious all at once that he would have gotten himself into what the Americans called, what was it, a jelly? No, a pickle, one of them had said. Why a pickle? No, a jam. He'd gotten himself into a jam, having pulled himself out of much worse situations. He was going to die of the cold on a dirt road in a place so unnoticed by the world that you could build a bomb there that would very well blow everything up. He wondered to himself if they'd built the tower at the test site. He had looked at a map carefully when he first arrived, not much in the south. A long stretch of desert down there, low mountains, flat areas, a few villages. No real city until you got to El Paso. Good place to detonate a bomb and close your eyes. They would have to solve several problems first, and he wondered how they were doing. The old sense of purpose came back to him briefly. Had they solved the purely mechanical problems, the cracks in the molds, the falling spike? It would take a while to move everything south to the test place. It would have to be not too far from the hill so they could get everything down there in a day at the most. They might be transporting men, even now, and the thing itself, the core. God, he thought, how are they going to move that? In cotton swaddling, Slotin had said, wrapped like a babe in the manger. That morning, Slotin had greeted him with a slap on the back, his narrow boy's face full of light and promise, frozen in Leo's memory. Leo will always see Slotin standing in front of him, his white lab coat open, his hands in his pockets, making a joke about the mud. They began the experiment. The idea was to move two hemispheres towards each other on a rod to allow them to reach only the first step and then separate them so as to avoid, as Slotin used to say, a little accident. Slotin was moving the two half-moons together with screwdrivers. The counter ticked and the red signal lights were blinking. Leo was behind him, writing on the board with a chalk. A screwdriver fell to the floor. The meter stopped. Leo heard the silence first. He half turned. The room was filled with blue light. Leo yelled, "Raushaus dem Feuer," to Slotin. And as he screamed, he saw out of the corner of his eye that the lights had stopped flickering. They were glowing, a bead of red. "Get out of the fire." But Slotin leaned forward and with his bare hands separated the hemispheres to keep them from reaching critical mass, saving Leo, the assistant, the room, the lab, and the city, and sacrificing himself. Leo heard himself shouting. Slotin turned slowly and with great courtesy, told Leo to be quiet, please. The assistant was standing by the door. Slotin told them both to stand still, not to move, please. He walked to the chalkboard and drew their positions, estimating their distance from the assembly. He looked over his shoulder at Leo. "What do you think?" he said. 7 feet? Leo nodded, his head feeling like a balloon made of tissue. Slotin said, "So they will know how much you got." Leo watched Slotin write. His hand was already turning red. "Okay," Slotin said, and then he turned and the three of them walked outside. They sat down beside the muddy road. Leo looked across at one of the green buildings. It was as if the whole town had gone silent. Leo could think of nothing to say. And then Slotin turned to him and said, "You will come out all right." He patted his arm. Leo nodded. And then Slotin said, this time with a second of catch in his voice, "But I haven't the faintest chance myself." Thank you. Thank you.
Well, from the sublime to the ridiculous. What I thought I'd do... I'm feeling mischievous tonight. So what I would like to read for you is something that I actually started at the McDowell Colony at the end of that experience. After I'd rewritten Lying Awake, the Nun book, which is very short, so it didn't take very long, I still had some time, and I actually had brought with me all of this material that I'd gathered as a writing teacher at Juvenile Hall here in downtown, Central Juvenile Hall. Near the USC Medical Center there. I had been shamed into teaching a writing class there as a volunteer for 4 years, and I had brought with me a bunch of the kids' work because I thought maybe I would try to write something about that experience. And I eventually did. One of the things that I wrote while I was there is describing what happened to me when the editor sent one of my failed drafts of Lying Awake back. So I'd like to read that for you. Because it just sort of, I don't know, because I want to. So, my birthday fell on a Wednesday that year. I should have been in a celebratory mood, having just finished a draft of my novel about the nun. The boys' reaction to my confession of discouragement had shaken me out of my writer's block, and their willingness to bare their souls at our little writer's retreat gave me the courage to send the manuscript off to my publisher. Unfortunately, inspiration and courage had not saved me from writing a bad book. My editor's puzzled reaction to the manuscript led me to read it once more, and by page 50, I wanted to slit my wrists. When at last the story reached its improbable yet unsatisfying conclusion, I wondered, how could I have ever thought this was good? And I should mention that the boys that I was teaching in this class were all being tried as adults because of the severity of their crimes. So they were kids, but they were being tried in adult court, mostly murder charges, all gang involved. So they were really what most of us would describe as sort of dead-end kids. But they were remarkable writing students and very supportive, as you'll soon see. My wife, knowing I was inconsolable, did not insist that we celebrate that year. Before I left for juvenile hall that night, she stopped at a bakery and picked up some eclairs for me to bring to the kids. When I got to the unit and the boys had all sat down, I opened the box and saw to my horror that she had spelled out the phrase, "Happy Birthday, Mark," on one of the eclairs with candy letters. "It's your birthday?" Kevin asked, looking pained. "What you doing here?" "Yeah, you should be out partying, Mark." "Damn, you should have told us." Francisco's single eyebrow bunched up. "We would have got you a card or something, man. Now I feel bad." I felt an explanation was due, so I told him about the setback with the book. "I'm not discouraged, though, just not in a happy birthday mood. That's all. Don't worry about it." But the boys fell silent. Francisco was beginning to look dangerous. He was staring red-faced out the window with a clenched fist pressing into his thigh. Then he let it out. "Fuck your editor." "Yeah, Mark," Kevin agreed. "Fuck him. You can go somewhere else." "Well, my editor's a woman." "Well, fuck her then." "I'm telling you for real," Francisco said, his voice shaking. "She don't know. She don't know what the fuck she's talking about." "Well, it's okay, Francisco." "It's not okay." He bolted upright, sending his chair crashing against the bookshelf. "She don't know you. She don't know you. Come down here and help us out. She don't know shit. Who is she to judge you? She's just a bitch. What the fuck does she know about anything?" Mr. Jenkins, one of the guards, opened the door and leaned in. "Javier, what's going on?" "Somebody fucked with my teacher, that's what's going on." "Sit down, Javier." "I ain't sitting down." Mr. Jenkins let the rest of his body into the room. "You heard me, sit down." "Some bitch told Mark he wrote a bad book, and it's his fucking birthday." Mr. Jenkins glanced at me, then at the open box on the table. "Mmm," he said, "eclairs." "Have one," I said, feeling worse than ever. "There's plenty." "Don't mind if I do." Mr. Jenkins finished off the eclair in two bites and then asked, "Who said you wrote a bad book?" I explained the situation, emphasizing that my editor was on my side and was only trying to help me by being honest. It was a professional obligation to be critical, I pointed out. He nodded and asked if there were enough eclairs to give to the other staff on duty that night. "Yeah, there's a dozen there." "Thanks." He took a couple out of the box and made toward the door, where he paused and turned around and said, "Fuck your editor, by the way." "Yes!" Francisco shouted, pumping a fist in the air, and Mr. Jenkins frowned. "The difference, Javier, is I can say that without jumping up and down like a fool and busting furniture. You got love for your teacher, I see that, but you got to learn to control your emotions, otherwise they control you, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. Don't make me come back in here." So that was my birthday. Oh, my goodness, yeah. Oh, they helped me through. Yeah. Now, so we thought we'd chat a little bit about writing and whether it's, writing colonies, writing at home, and then open it up to questions. So I would like, can I begin with a question for you, Nora?
Certainly, sir, you can.
Nora, you have written books, nonfiction books and a novel. How is the experience of writing nonfiction and fiction different for you, or is it? Is it the same process?
Well, it's equally miserable, Mark. No, I think actually you said it earlier. We were talking about this earlier, and because it isn't actually very common for people to go between nonfiction and fiction, and I think you're one of the few people I know who does the same thing I do, equally well, I might add. But the truth is, as Mark was saying this earlier, I ran out of material in my own life. I'd published two memoirs, and I couldn't think of anything else to write about. Yeah. So I'd always wanted to write about New Mexico. This is really my love story to New Mexico. But I had been very much afraid of writing fiction. I think fiction has a kind of dark cloud over it, which is, you know, the gates are guarded by the big fiction writers, you know, George Eliot, Leo Tolstoy. They're there. And if you can't write like them, you can't write fiction. So I was a lot scared, much more scared. At one point, in the middle of the second draft, I think it was the first draft, I was in the middle. The middle is always a very hard point for me. I walked into my husband's office. He's also a writer, and he works at the front of the house. I work in the back of the house. I walked into his study. We never interrupt each other, you know, during writing, because we try to leave each other alone. But I walked right into his study, and I said, "I can't do this." And he said, he didn't even lift his fingers off the keyboard. He said, "Shut up and get back to work." Sort of like Jessica, you know, they're not nice. Anyway, Ben, how about you?
Well, the best description of a comparison of fiction and nonfiction that I've heard actually is my wife, Jessica, who's a filmmaker, but she makes documentary films, but she also does dramatic films as well. And I asked her that question, you know, how she compared it. She said, well, the way it seems to me is that with documentary, the footage exists. Your real creative, the creative part of it comes when then you choose how to organize it, how to present it, what to put in, what to leave out, and then you start to discover what the theme is and how you feel about it. And so, but you begin with the footage exists, whereas with fiction, you have to first generate the footage. And so it's, for her, it's an extra step. And I feel that's very much true with fiction, is once I actually know who the characters are and the plot I want, I have in mind, then the day-to-day process feels very similar. It's just, the problem is with fiction, because you have unlimited choice, infinite choice, that's paralyzing, I think. That I think, is the greatest challenge for mm-hmm. me, is that it's just overwhelming that you can do anything, so then how do you go about whittling down? Whereas with nonfiction, you can't, I mean, hopefully you don't make things up. Mm-hmm. Some do. But the idea is you're supposed to be true to what happens, and it's how you present it is... Mm-hmm. So I would say that for me, the day-to-day process is neither more or less difficult. It's just that first stage of getting to the point where I really know who the people are, what they're going to go through before I actually get down to work, that's the hardest part for me.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
Daunting.
Yeah, that's good.
And my other question I have for you is, did the experience that you had, have had at Colonies writing, under those sort of ideal circumstances, solitude, people, you know, bring me lunch in baskets and they tiptoe away so as not to disturb the artistic process. Has that affected the way you write in general? Does it have carryover into your writing life at home, or is it only, can you only get it there?
I have hired some people to bring me lunch.
Yeah.
I'm at home, as you are, I'm sure, and, you know, and, well, in, you know, the old writing fatigues. eating writer's kibble. I don't think it's, at least for me, not quite translatable. I think that I realized how great the Colonies are, in the sense that you can really inhabit your work. I mean, you can really be walking across the lawn at the end of the day and think about the characters and not have your, you know, bills or your email or the mailman interrupt you. And that I grew to love that. I grew to love daydreaming about my novel or that's not possible for me to do at home. But I think that there's some glimmer of that feeling of true friends and the community living there as if it were an ideal place that I know exists and that I know that it's possible to get close to that again. And I think it's true that one of the good things it did for me was confidence, that you realize that under ideal circumstances, you really can write. And so even under bad circumstances, you can approximately write. So I think it really gave me something like that. How about you?
Well, the effect that it had on me that has had carryover, because I agree with you that there's no way that at home you can recreate the circumstance of being able to think without interruption for such long stretches of time, really. And that is a great a privilege. But I remember just as I was leaving, as I was preparing to leave, I took out a notebook. I said, you know, I've got to remember what are the things that really worked here, and I've got to try and make this work at home. And the first one, and this is the one that really was the most profound, is that my approach to life is essentially what I call the Boy Scout, the Eagle Scout approach, which is that I've always been convinced that I can't really go out and live a life until I'm fully qualified with skills that I've acquired. And there has to be proof of it. People have to know that I have these skills. And then at last, I'm qualified, and then I can go about living my life or writing or doing whatever I want to do. So I have this idea, I've got to be prepared. So I'm forever trying to acquire skills and learn and get better at things. And the thing is, I'm often wearing myself out doing that. So right before I left, I was, you know, not only working on this book, but of course I wanted to learn the 6-box suite so I could play them all on my birthday. And, you know, I wanted to learn Spanish because, I don't know, I just thought I should learn Spanish. So I was using tapes, and, you know, doing all this stuff. And when I got there, I just dropped it all. And at the end of the 5 weeks, I wasn't a worse person. I wasn't, you know, disqualified from life. And I said to myself, you know, I think I have to be able to, I have to do less. I think I just have to loosen my grip on this idea that I have to be doing all this stuff to be worthy. And that was that had a lasting effect. I, to this day, I haven't pulled a shell out of his basket. So, yeah, it's that was really, really good. And the other thing is that I had this feeling when I was there that there was nothing I could have done consciously to hurry that process. Mm. That book, I had to go through that for me to finally figure out how to write it. And so what I tried to remind myself is that I should be gentle with myself, not get angry at yourself for things not happening fast enough, because that's one thing you really can't control. Mm-hmm. A book seems to take as long as it takes. It takes you as long as it takes to have your insight, your understanding. And I wish I was Mozart or, you know, one of these people that, you know, understands things instantly, but I'm not. I have to write a book every conceivable wrong way till there's only the right way left. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm stuck with, and I've got to make the most of it. So that was, I felt like I allowed myself to be gentle with myself, and that's been a great helps, especially now with young kids, I really have very little uninterrupted time, and I can't go to any colonies and won't be able to for a long, 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 long time. But it doesn't depress me, because I feel like, as you say, even though my writing process is interrupted, I'm not as productive. I have convinced myself, even if it may be a rationalization, but I have convinced myself that's okay. That I do feel now like I am where I should be, doing what I should be doing. And it's great to fool yourself so completely. So
I was going to ask you about that. How do you manage to be a stay-at-home dad? And you really are a stay-at-home dad, often a sole parent and with two little kids.
Well, it hasn't been great for the writing, but it's been great for living. You know, when I was at McDowell, actually, I remember one night playing pool with a guy who, and I was sharing my wine in a box, so we were both feeling great. And at one point, he said, "Mark, you know, you're a good writer. Don't let life get in the way." And I thought about that afterwards, and I thought, well, you know, the truth is, I got into writing because I wanted writing to be a means through which I understood how to live. I didn't do it the other way around. I don't want to live in order to become a great writer. I, frankly, if I had to choose between having a good life and being a great writer, I'd choose the life. I've always hoped that writing would be a way that I would figure out how to live. So it's okay, in my view, if life doesn't get in the way. Life's the point. The writing's supposed to support that. So I feel now that's what's happening, that those lessons I learned from writing about being patient, about not feeling I can't be in control of everything, are really helpful at the times when, you know, both of them are screaming about something and, you know, I want control and I can't have it. And you all know the deal, right? You're just... and the worst, okay, here's, I think, the hardest thing about parenting is it's fine if you can handle anything. as long as you're convinced that that's just all you need to be thinking about. But if you think you should be doing something else, it's hell. If you're thinking, I should be working out that character problem, can you just shut the hell up? Then you're in two places at once. You're at war with yourself. Whereas if you can just say, you know what? I'm not going to get any work done today. That's that. Then it's bearable. So I feel like writing has, you know, helped me in that way. So far, so good. Now, it looks like it's a good time now maybe to open up to questions from abroad. Would anyone like to chat about writing? Oh, someone raised their hand. And we have a microphone, so if you would just hold off until we get that to you, and then everyone can hear, and off we'll go.
Mark, it sounded so painful listening to you talking about that poor nun. And I was just wondering, is there ever a time when you would allow yourself to just put the project away forever? Or do you have too much invested at a certain point that you're just going to keep working on it till something comes out of it?
Well, that's a great question. I don't have an answer to that, because it's possible. It could happen, maybe. Right now, I'm in misery. I've been working on a novel now. This is my sixth year. It's set in China at the time of the Mongol invasion. And I thought I'd finish it in a year, because I was so sure when I started it, I knew exactly what it was about. And I've written now, I've turned in three completely different novels, different characters, different plots, and all three of them just got sent back. No. And she's right. They're really wrong. And so I'm right now in the middle of that feeling like, what is wrong with my brain? Why can't I get to the heart of it? Why do I write these things that then when they're finished, I look at it and realize I'm completely off track. This isn't about anything that anyone really would be that interested in. It's not about a fundamental human problem. I somehow got sidetracked and it gets mixed up and blah, blah, blah. So I'm in the middle of that. The question, would I ever give it up? I guess there probably would be a point when I might, but right now I don't feel that way because I'm still completely fascinated by the material and the theme that I feel is in there somewhere. See, I feel about writing that writing is like an itch. You know, people often say, to be a writer, do you have to be self-disciplined? And I don't think a writing is taking discipline. It's like if you have an itch in the middle of your back that you can't reach, you will get creative about ways to reach it. And it's not discipline that makes you do that. It's just you want resolution. You want satisfaction of whatever it is that's... And so there's something about this story, about this journey that I want this character to take through overwhelming circumstances, this siege, this invasion, all this stuff, and yet I sense that this character, many people would be crushed by this, but I sense that this character would be freed by it somehow. I know this is what I want to write about, but I can't quite figure out how to make it happen. I can't stop because nothing interests me more. So yeah. It's a mental disorder. We're all crazy, but we're high functioning, and this is our—you know—we're self-medicating with this activity.
What about trying, what about trying something like researching the history of China, the theory behind your work? For example, I don't know, look at Plato, look at what Aristotle thought about the meaning of life, that sort of thing. What about going to China? What about looking at the characters, what do they do for work, and stay stalking a doctor, you know, stalking a psychiatrist for a couple of months, or, you know, whatever, none, you know, going into, why didn't you go into where the priests were? Why didn't you stay with the priests for a couple of years in order to really get into the story? I mean, if you didn't feel the characters, why not dive in there? And I mean, why were you stuck? Why didn't you try those approaches?
I did. You're describing
you did
my
all those things.
Life. Yeah. Well, that leads to a question, Nora. When you're writing this book, now you grew up in that area. Mm-hmm. What kind of research did you have to do, or did you do, or what? You know, how did you prepare to write this book?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you said about the footage with a novel, because I think you have to have something. I mean, what you're saying, you have to have something that gives you some material that you're working with, even though you're also creating the world. I went back to New Mexico and sort of retraced all of the steps to Santa Fe, Los Alamos, the river. I figured out all the geography and then went to Los Alamos, looked at the museums there. I did sort of everything I'd done before but wanted to do again and refresh my memory, and then read a lot of books. I mean, tons of, there are some wonderful books, and there's a lot of new material on Los Alamos and the bomb that's really only come out in the last, say, 10, 15 years. So that was really helpful. But yeah, I think that you have to have some sense of the factual basis of a novel to give you the sinews, if you will, to give you the stuff that holds the muscle together.
Yeah. No, your point is absolutely right. I mean, when I was writing Lying Awake, I visited one Carmelite monastery in New Mexico. Great place. Mm-hmm. It's been good to me. And the prioress at this place suggested, she said, well, you know, to really know what our life is like, one thing you really ought to do is you ought to let me teach you how we, at what hours we do our reading, the sacred reading, and let me give you the schedule of the readings. And at those hours, you should read exactly what we read and do that for a period of time. I would suggest a year. So I did that. And it was remarkable. It just, it absolutely, it gave me a concrete idea of how to describe what kind of, how the day would spread out. And especially the way that for them, she was explaining, now there are going to be times you'll be reading this at, you know, 5:30 in the morning or so, when you're not really going to have a whole lot of comprehension. Your mind's going to be distracted. She said, that's acceptable. That's all right. The point is not that you train yourself to be thinking hard about this all the time. It's that you make it a regular thing that these images, these phrases, these ideas are echoing in your mind, so that the analogy she made, she said, it's a little bit like a piano. If you have only a single string and you block out all the other strings, play a single string, the note that you will hear will be relatively simple. But if you have all the other strings, hit that same string and the others will resonate. Mm. They will vibrate in resonance, and it creates a complexity, a depth of sound to that single note. She said, for us, because we have this liturgy going through our mind, ringing in our minds through the day and through the night, it just means that an ordinary experience, like, you know, picking up a cup, it may then trigger a passage about running streams and a deer returning to it leaves you in a state constantly of having your soul be refreshed and reminded of what you really consider dear. Well, that was such a great experience for me that ever since then now, I've kept up with it. Although I don't read the liturgy that they read, I made my own little project to find what are the little passages of all kinds of literature that just calm me or inspire me or just give me goosebumps. And I've just got a whole bunch of them. I've got them by my bed. And now every night before bed, that's what I read. And every morning when I get up, I read a little of that. Now, Jessica, my wife, who's just very, very funny, she just says, but Mark, I don't get this. You've already read that before. Why don't you use that time to read new stuff? But that's, you know, that's not the point. I think someone said we need to be reminded of far more than we need to learn. And that's definitely true for me.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Could you speak a little bit? I was online reading about the colony this afternoon, and there seemed to be a social component to this. Could you both speak to what that did for you? You mentioned that you met some of your best friends there, and how that contributed to the writing process?
Sure. I mean, I think that it's not often in the middle of your life when you spend at least a month to 6 weeks away with other people living in really dorm conditions, you know, and dining together. And that's really the last time I did that was college, I think. And so I didn't realize that circumstance creates friendship, that you know, the dear friends I have from college partly is because we spend so much time together, just, you know, hanging out and talking and reading and eating together and sleeping in the same place, you know, that all of that creates the ground for friendship. And added to that, at the colonies, you're all working in, even if the fields aren't the same fields, they're related. So if someone's a visual artist or someone's a writer, you really are, you have a lot of overlapping stuff to talk about. I mean, one of the most wonderful things about being in a colony for me was being in a colony with, or several colonies with musicians, that I never could figure out how people compose music. You know, how do they do that? And I got a good sense of it from talking to people, from my friend John Hollenbeck and various other jazz musicians. I got a sense of how that happens, and that sort of wonderful, the wonderful life of creativity that expresses itself in so many different ways is just amazing. So you're really living in that whole soup of other people doing things and having breakthroughs and also stumbling around in the dark. I mean, it's wonderful to see that visual artists don't know any more about what they're doing than writers. I mean, that it's really another question of throwing something on the page or in this case that, you know, the board and not knowing whether it's going to work or not. So all of that I think is great. And then there's just the drinking that.
Yeah, and I think there's something really stimulating about being with a group of people who are all there for the same reason. Everybody wants to be reminded of why they got into art in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so it's a similar thing. You know, really, there's nobody there saying, I've got to make this thing commercial. Nobody's saying, like, if this doesn't sell, I'm sunk. Everybody's there because they want to be reminded of what's important about this. They want to feel free. They want to feel good. The other thing is that the social component is optional. It's entirely up to you how much social life you want to have, and that's very nice. There were some people when I was there who really just wanted, they didn't really want to socialize too much. They more or less kept to themselves. The way it worked at McDowell is that you have your own cabin. That's your workspace, and it's sacred. No one can go visit without an invitation. A person could be thrown out for doing that. So that's a sacred place, but you can invite anyone you want, mm-hmm. but everyone kind of understands. Then there's a sort of dining hall area where for dinner, everyone eats in the same dining hall. Now, you can eat by yourself if you want, but generally, by the end of the day, most everybody wants a little chatting. And then you can, if you want, you can go back to your cabin, or you can just hang out and play pool or chat, listen to music. And I think it was once a week, there's a sort of a tradition where if people want to present, talk about what they're doing, they give a little presentation. And at first I thought, oh gosh, is this required? You know, I remember I just didn't want to be pushed in anything, but it isn't required. Some people didn't participate at all, but I ended up loving these things because, like, you would hear a composer would just talk about his piece he's working on. There was a sculptor who was talking about this piece she was working on. I've never talked to a composer, a sculptor before, and so it was fun to hear them talk about it, and that maybe they would invite you to their studio, have an evening, wine and cheese, look at their work. So it's there if you want it. And I found that even though I went thinking I'm going to be the hermit because I just, you know, I don't want any stress, I ended up, I just fell in love with everybody. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun. This is the smartest thing to do. If you go to one of these things, my sister-in-law, who's the most generous person in the world, because I celebrated my birthday when I was there, she sent me from iGourmet.com a cheese selection of incredible cheese. Well, it's more than I could eat. So I said, hey, you know, everyone come over to my studio and have cheese. Oh, my God, I was the most popular guy. From then on, everybody thought I was the greatest guy in the world. So this is a good way to,
food.
Yeah,
just, bring food.
Food.
yeah. It is like college, yeah.
I find that one of the most rewarding things about writing is the moment when you finally fall fully into the world that you're making, whether it's a world that you had lived in earlier in your life or one you're making up whole cloth, but that the hard part is falling in. And what's great about it is that once you do, you really would rather be living there than in the real world, and you can't wait to get back. And that's when things really start picking up speed. But the hard part is getting there. It's kind of like flying an old single-engine prop plane. You have to even get the propeller moving, much less take off. And I was wondering, since, unless you're Joyce Carol Oates or somebody, you're usually not there long enough to write a whole novel. So is it better to try to go when you're still trying to fall into the world? You need that isolation. You don't want anything else impinging. Uh-huh. Or is it better to go once you really are picking up speed and you're there and that's all you want to do is live there and nowhere else?
That's a good question. I think it's... I have known people who arrived at some place like McDowell where you are in, you know, given a cottage that's or a cabin that's all yours, and literally no one will disturb you, and so you can go crazy there all by yourself. That people have come there before the story was really moving, and really had a rough time. I mean, it's a dangerous proposition, I think, to arrive at a colony when the propeller is sort of not even quite in the turning stage, because you can sort of get lost in that brooding part of creativity. On the other hand, and so I think the perfect proposition is to go when you're moving along and you just need to be in that world, as you say. But that's a very idealistic view. I mean, you can't know how it's going to go. So I think there's always, I don't know if this is true for you, but it's always true for me that there's a level of extreme pain right before I fall into the actual creative world, that there's just this resistance, this tremendous resistance that translates for me into, anxiety and brooding and whatever else I can think of before I actually get into the creative stream. There's some way in which, at least I know that now, that's the precursor, and it will always be there. And then at some point you fall into the world, as you say, and then it starts to move. But I go through that almost every day. I mean, I still at the colonies you can live in that world longer, and so it's not so hard starting in the morning. But I think it's always a resisting thing. It's hard to keep it going.
And I have a sort of naive view that, this naive faith that when it finally happens, that I'm really turned on, I just expect that it's going to replay itself out. I just can't imagine anything really obstructing it. Somehow you find a way. You're just so turned on. The last moment I had, the last time I had a feeling like that, when I was writing something short, my daily task is I had to take my younger daughter to a preschool, and I had to stay there with her, and it was a two-hour program. Well, I found out that there was a little closet on the second floor of this room where the kids were, so I would sneak up there, and I wrote it up there while they were singing, "One of the World and the Hands on the Bus Go Around," and I didn't even hear it. I mean, those things that usually are like earworms that drive you nuts. So I always feel like when it finally happens, when you're falling, you're just going to fall. Nothing's going to stop you. The question, the problem that I'm always wrestling with is that how do you convince yourself, how do you calm yourself when you're not falling and you think somehow you've got to dig your way there? You're thinking you should be in control of it because it's falling is the perfect analogy. It is a sense of surrender. It seems to happen of itself. But when it's not there, you feel obliged. Well, this is my job. I've got to make something happen. And you're trying to use your will to force it to happen. That's the hardest thing, is how to deal with that anxiety that comes up, that feeling I should be doing something. And the more you think that, the less happens.
I grew up in Peterborough, New Hampshire, which is the town that the McDowell colony is in. And we moved there because my father was a painter, and it made a profound impact on my brothers and I in our whole lives, because you don't realize as a colonist that there's a whole group of people out there that are looking at you every day, and as kids we always thought the most ideal situation would be to have somebody bring you lunch in a basket every day. That was our dream. So my brother and I recently applied, and we were joint colonists a few summers ago, and to be on the inside, as opposed to looking at it from the outside, was an incredible experience. And I think that it's something for you to realize the impact that you make on the kids in the neighborhood and the aspiring writers and architects and artists in the world. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I know that tinfoil skirts are big in New Hampshire now. Yeah. Well, that's just, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah. No.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.